Like a lot of people, the journalist Michael Finkel was fascinated by the story of a Frenchman named Stefan Breitweiser as it played out in the newspapers. For years, Breitweiser had managed to steal hundreds of pieces of priceless art from more than 200 museums. Now, I say priceless, but people have actually worked out the value of these objects and sculptures and paintings that he took. They've come up with a figure of $2 billion. For years and years, he got away with it. And when he finally got caught, Michael Finkel wanted to talk to him, wanted to write about his crimes, because unlike all the other art thieves in history, Breitweiser actually loved the art. So Finkel sent him a letter. And 2 years later, he heard back.
The first time I ever met Stefan Breitweiser, he agrees to meet me for lunch, as long as I don't bring a pen or a recorder. And he picks this restaurant in this, like, 17th century old Alsatian house. And I meet him. He's a little below average height, whippet thin, sort of looking at me. And it's a nerve-wracking moment. I'm a journalist. I've been a journalist for a long time. But you meet someone like the world's greatest art thief, and you can't help but be nervous. And I'm speaking in my second language, French. Now, he had never spoken with an American before, and obviously I always want people to speak in their natural native language. So the thing that I recall most about this first lunch is wishing to speak about another subject, but only talking about movies we liked and hikes we went on and things I'd written about before, all the while sort of like, when do we get to the good part? But again, the point of that whole lunch was, will you permit me to interview you? And really heavily concentrating.
So this introductory lunch or whatever it was goes well. Breitweiser agrees to talk about the good stuff with Michael Finkel in a series of interviews.
Anybody who's traveled in Europe might know that hotels there are quite small, like walk-in closet size small. And so I rent this tiny hotel room. There's only one chair, which I'm a polite person. I tell Stefan to sit in the chair, and I sit on the luggage rack. And there's this tiny table between us. And I have a little Mac laptop that I kept closed on the table, but he's quite the autodidact, made lots of references to painters and styles, and I always wanted to flip it open and look up something. So I just put that between us, and we commence on this interview. And now, one of the things that I just couldn't get my head around, I just don't understand how you can steal a work of art when a guard is in the room. I mean, of all the things that are like hard to comprehend, that's one of them. But in a series of questions, I'm like, how is it possible, Stefan? I just don't understand how you can steal while people are in the room. Guards, people whose job it is to keep track of this stuff. How is that possible? And I looked up at him and he said to me, did you just see what I did? No. And he says to me, look around. And I'm like, Stefan, I'm sorry. I don't see anything. And he stands up and turns around and he lifts up his shirt, and tucked into the waistband of his pants is my laptop. He literally could have walked out of the hotel room, and 10 minutes later when it's time to check my email, I'd be like, where is my computer? So he, during, 4 seconds that my eyes were lowered to take a note, he had managed to take my computer, put it in there, lift up his shirt, put it back, and sit down in the chair as if nothing had happened. And it was that moment, more than any explanation, that demonstration really made me understand how someone can steal a work of art right under your nose.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Michael Finkel is talking about his book. It's called The Art Thief, a true story of love, crime, and a dangerous obsession.
I guess really the only thing you can go on when you're a journalist is what I kind of call my journalistic spidey senses. Like, you know, there's not like, oh, this, therefore good story. You know, it's just sort of a feel thing.
Yeah.
And I'm reading about this guy. And first I read about this insane quantity of crimes. I mean, museums have been open for about 300 years since the 17th century. And in all that time, and trust me, I've done a ridiculous amount of research. I've spent 11 years on this project. I think that the second most prolific art thief of all time stole from like 19 museums.
Wow.
And Stefan Breitbeser stole from 201. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not even really a second place. So there's that. But that wasn't even the thing that got the spidey senses really going. Then I read that he stole during the day, we mentioned, under people's noses, daylight, nonviolent, not even the threat of violence. That's beautiful. But that even wasn't the thing that drove me to obsession. It was the fact that he stole for the love of art and not for money. And we'll talk about that, I'm sure. But, of course, so I call up a French guy. This is the real reason, actually. I'm kind of a competitive guy. I don't know if we really want to get into this, but I called up a couple of my French journalist friends. And one of them said the magic words to me. She said to me, that guy doesn't talk to the media, and he definitely won't talk to an American. And I'm telling you right now, not to sound cocky, I was like, game on. And I guess my secret in life, I'm going to give it away to you all. You know, everybody sends text messages and emails. You know what's really a nice thing to do? Write a handwritten letter.
Yeah.
Pen, ink, envelope, stamp. All those things still exist. And I wrote him a letter in my weird French, tried my hardest. Heartfelt saying, I'd really like to talk to you. And it took 2 years for a response, but that started the whole ball rolling.
One of the things you have said is that you thought that people are going to want skylight entries and shootouts and smoke bombs. But you said that's not what this book is about. Explain that. And what is this book about?
Okay, so there's two kinds of art thieves in the world. Fictitious. And real.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, I love movies and I love reading novels. So all the ones from the movies and novels are, you know, Tom Cruise in it out and, you know, blasting through things and there's always infrared lasers somewhere. That sounds great.
Yeah.
That's not the way you really steal art. In the whole history of, you know, art crime, Stefan Breitbeser had a theory about thieving, which was that the fewer people who are aware, if no one's aware that it's happening, that's the best way, the worst way to get something out of a museum is to make a big commotion, bust out a gun and a smoke bomb. And I was fascinated by his techniques, which were all about subterfuge and sort of hidden tricks. You know, as he said to me multiple times, he loves watching movies. You know, if you really want to see all that stuff, you can rent a movie. But if you actually want to bring a piece of art home, that's a terrible way to do it, how they do it in the movies.
Can you then, with that in mind, take us through this moment? This is one of the thefts that you write about at the Rubenshaus Museum in Belgium. This is February 1997. It's actually the first chapter of the book. And as you put it in the book, it's lunchtime, which is stealing time. Take us through this moment.
Okay. Again, as I mentioned, so Breitbeser's theory was the invisible style. So like, what's the best way to gain entry to a museum? And that is through the front door.
Yeah.
Just buy a ticket. Buy it with cash. Don't put your credit card down. That's a rookie mistake right there. Mm-hmm. And so Breitbeser, he often, almost all the time, was accompanied by his accomplice, his girlfriend, and Catherine Kleinklaus. It's always good to have an accomplice if anybody out there is thinking about stealing art. I'd say a very trustworthy accomplice is a necessity. Of course, I'm being facetious. I really love museums and breaks my heart that anybody would portray the public trust in the way that Breitbeser did, but gosh, his methods were fascinating. So he walks into museum by just paying for a ticket, and in fact, often made a point of being polite to the ticket vendor, hello and bonjour, and doing all those things. You know why he would do this? Sometimes you didn't even ask guards directions to a particular gallery, even if he already knew. And why would he do this? Why would you say hello? Why would you ask a guard directions? Because that is exactly something that an art thief would not do.
Yeah.
It really allays suspicion in this kind of ingenious sort of counterintuitive style. Breitbeser would walk into a museum. He looked like he had nothing on him. All he needed to steal a work of art was a Swiss Army knife and a jacket if it was cool enough. If not, just a shirt that was untucked. I mean, talk about simplicity. He loved ivory. Ivory, if you're a aficionado, I mean, I feel like all ivory should still be attached to an elephant, but we're talking about ivory from the 1600s.
Yeah.
He loved ivory. It has this sort of internal glow, and I'm sure we'll talk about Bret Visser's aesthetic style, but it just fired in him the love of beauty. Everyone has their own definition of what they think is the most beautiful, but he loved ivory, and he saw this piece of sculpted by Patel, a German sculptor of the Renaissance era, and it was just beautifully detailed, 10 inches tall, and sealed, of course, in a plexiglass box, as things tend to be in a museum. And it's in this perfect, by the way, you know, this is the room you want to pick. He couldn't steal everything he liked, but it had to have this combination of the right size, the right spot in a museum, and most important to Breitweiser, the right emotional content. Like, you had to love it, as Bret Visser told me often. If you really want to make money, stealing art is, there's way easier ways to make money than stealing art. He sort of poo-pooed the direction of almost every other art thief. He used a Swiss Army knife. He noted that the plexiglass box was sealed only by two screws, and that was a really good sign. And all he had to do was undo two screws to get at this ivory. He positions his girlfriend, Anne Catherine, at the doorway to this room, and their signal was a little brief cough is all you needed, and he would move away. Now, Bret Visser is highly athletic, completely risk comfortable, and pretty speedy at his job. He waited for a moment when no guards were coming by. You mentioned lunchtime. Lunchtime's a great time to steal, because if there's a museum that has a guard in every room, which is frequent, during lunchtime, they'll often rotate shorthanded to eat. So suddenly, instead of a guard being in each room, there's one sort of walking around and coming in every 10 minutes. Anyway, during between guard visits, he managed to unscrew both of these screws, remove the top of this plexiglass box, take the Adam and Eve ivory, stick it where he stuck my computer, like in the waistband of his pants, covered it with his jacket. Now, don't run. He knew that. If you're running through a museum, that is a bad sign. Walking out the front door, often saying goodbye, going to his car, putting it gently down. Now, I really wanted him to like screech off, like speeding away, which is, you know, again, one of those infrared lights, you know, skylight entries. No, it's just, imagine his escape drive was really slowly. Most museums are in the middle of town. He stopped cautiously at red lights and waited for traffic. And then once he hit the highway, he accelerated. And that's what he told me, when his guard could be let down. But sort of this simplicity combined with daring and a great way to read people and just a perfect sense of timing.
You write that Stefan is not really an art thief. At least this is the thing that he – I'm sure he still believes this. What does it mean? Because he has an issue with art thieves. Their techniques, their regard for art, it all disgusts him.
As I mentioned, I worked on this for more than a decade, and to this day – I'm not 100% sure how I feel about Bret Visser. You know, he had this twisted logic that also kind of weirdly appealed to me.
Yeah.
Here's the world's, I mean, it's really not an exaggeration to say the world's greatest art thief is telling me that he doesn't like to be called an art thief. Now,
yeah,
he didn't deny stealing 201 times 300 works, but he just hated other art thieves.
Mm.
Real art thieves hate art. I think the most famous crime in the United States in recent decades is the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist of 1990, where the two men that broke in, first of all, they attacked the guards, bound them up with duct tape, handcuffed them to pipes in the basement, already not Breitweiser's cup of tea. But the worst thing that they did was they went to the most beautiful piece of work in the museum, a Rembrandt seascape, and I kind of get the heebie-jeebies even mentioning it, stuck a knife in the canvas and shredded the canvas along the edge. It's a huge work, 17 feet square, and just cut it out of its frame. In other words, if they ever find that Rembrandt, it still will never be whole. That to Bret Visser was anathema, the worst thing possible. He would never do that.
You admire that. There's something, when you were thinking about the story you just said a minute ago, there was something you found kind of, you're not a sucker. I mean, you know this guy has issues, which we'll talk about, but you find something admirable about that.
It's hard for me to, I mean, who doesn't go to a museum and look at a work and say, man, wouldn't that look, honey, wouldn't that look good over the mantel, please?
Yeah.
And, you know, who doesn't have that thought? And here's a person who pulled it off in the most admirable style possible. You know, again, not condoning anything, but if you're going to steal something, you should do it nonviolently without damaging the artwork, without looking for money. You know, he did it for love. And when you're in a museum, I fully admit it, like the being jostled and elbowed and, you know, hit with the ends of selfie sticks is not really the way that Leonardo da Vinci imagined you seeing the Mona Lisa, I imagine. It's, you know, how about laying on a bed with a glass of wine in the evening, way after museums are open, and being able to rub your fingers gently over the painting so you can feel the ridges of the each stroke. Now, that is a nice way to see a work of art. Breitbeser's believed that entirely, and I must admit, despite my veil of, you know, objective journalism, it really appealed to me. You know, I couldn't help but be kind of dragged into his mindset for a while.
You write in the book that when Breitwieser opened his eyes when he was living in this place, which I want you to talk about, one of the first things he sees is that ivory sculpture of Adam and Eve. But it wasn't just that was there. He could reach out, as you say, and caress it and touch it. But this place where he lived was – every inch was packed with objects and paintings. And you haven't been there when it was full, but you've been to the place. So describe this attic for us.
So Breitwieser is from the Alsace region, northeastern France. And he's from a city that you probably haven't heard of, Mulhouse. And the reason why you haven't heard of it is because Mulhouse is where they make – it's automobile manufacturing, chemical manufacturing. France is lovely. I lived there for 7 years, filled with beauty. And Mulhouse is probably the ugliest part of a beautiful country. Okay, so not only did he live in Mulhouse, he lived in like the really – ugly suburbs of Mulhouse, these cookie-cutter houses marching into the cornfields. So if you just pictured a box with a roof on it, like think about a house that a four-year-old would draw. His house looked like that on a street of similar houses, the most quotidian place imaginable. His mother lived on the ground floor. Yes, the world's greatest art thief lived with his mother. You go up this narrow set of stairs, and there's this wooden door, and you open this door, and there's like – we're talking attic rooms, low-ceilinged, and – I mean, I've seen video, and I really close my eyes and imagine this all the time. A room filled at its height with about 300 Renaissance works, all of them priceless, all of them from museums. We're talking gold and silver and 69 oil paintings from the Renaissance, every square inch packed. And in the middle of this magnificence, this like living treasure chest, is this four-poster bed that he and his girlfriend, Anne-Catherine, lived on. And as you mentioned, he had nightstands on both sides, and some of Breitwieser's most cherished works were there, including the Adam and Eve ivory. And he said that, you know, when he did wake up in the morning, he'd often just reach out and put his hands over like Eve's hair rolling down her back, or the, you know, the serpent coiled around the tree of knowledge. And I mean, two people actually lived in this basic — it put rooms in the Louvre to shame. This $2 billion worth of art in this little house in the Mulhouse suburbs. It seems insane. It is insane. It's fantastically insane.
Michael Finkel, his new book is The Art Thief, a true story of love, crime, and a dangerous obsession. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. Let's talk about Anne-Catherine. Anne-Catherine is his girlfriend. And in some ways, I think you've described it as having a kind of a love story element to it, certainly here. You've described the relationship as the most unhealthy relationship you've ever encountered. What's her role? I mean, she's the — you also described her as the magician's assistant. She's the accomplice, but just describe for people the part that she plays in this story.
Okay, so the main action of this book takes place in the late 90s and through the first half of the 2000s. And Breitwieser, who had his misadventures as a youth, a little shoplifting and occasional things, but he met this woman, Anne-Catherine Kleinklaus, when he was about 20 years old. And despite, you know, I mean, I did say it was unhealthy, and it is an unhealthy relationship, but I wasn't able to speak with Anne-Catherine herself, but Breitwieser gave me permission to see psychology reports. I talked with people who knew Anne-Catherine. I talked with Breitwieser himself endlessly. Everyone said the same thing. no matter what you might say about the relationship, those two people loved each other. And I fully and heartily agree with that. And Catherine herself could not deny this. There was the mysteries of love. And so they fell in love with each other. And there was just something about the way the two of them meshed that accidentally made them the perfect couple to steal art. You know, the magician's assistant, I feel like, is a good way to describe it. And I feel like, you know, the magician's assistant is really the one that makes every magic trick work. You know, she stood watch, but she also sort of had this great inner sense of, like, when it was too dangerous to steal, about three quarters of the time they went to a museum, either, I love the bright visitor said this to me, you know, either nothing in the museum was worthy of being in this attic, or it was just too risky to steal. And Bright Visor always wanted to steal, and Anne Catherine was sort of the limiting factor. And so, and you know, she would decide which something's too big when a guard was looking at them suspiciously, and he would do the action. They both really loved bringing work home to the attic the way Bright Visor described it to me. That's like walking up into the attic and adding another piece. Mm-hmm. It was like there was a reason why there was a four-poster bed in the middle of it.
Well, there was a sexual component to it, right? And I have to say, this is something that's really interesting about the way you describe his relationship with art, and maybe the way we think about art, what we want out of art. There is something tactile, maybe even sexual, certainly something raw about his connection, and I suppose her connection to art.
Right. So they loved each other, but I think what I liked most about working on this project, I mean, it was fun to interview Bright Visor, but it really changed the way I look at a work of art. It really changed it for it. It affected the way I experienced museums. Hmm. Bright Visor was a natural aesthete, meaning that he didn't study. He was an autodidact. He read a lot about art history. He could name everything. But really, when it came to looking at a work of art, he had that, don't they call that in yoga, like the sort of mind of a child, this sort of like emptiness, empty mind, like very much emotional. So, you know, when you look at a work of art and you're standing, you're with your friend and you're like, what do you see? You know, you're talking about form and content and symbolism and balance of pose and all this BS that is really filled, you know, that's what art professors speak about. That's what my big Jansen textbook that I remember from, you know, my freshman year seminar and what the tour guide will say. But really, let's just get down to business. What happens when you look at a painting of the Venus? What do you really see? What is what is someone with a completely aesthetically open mind? They see beauty. They see sexiness. I mean, come on. These are beautiful people. They're naked. Why do we deny that? Let's be open to that. It's a turn on. Like Adam and Eve, my gosh, the way that Patel sculpted them with this. I mean, I wish I had a body like that. That musculature, they're gripping each other. They're nude. They're young. They're vibrant. It's very sexy. And we've sort of lost that as artistic consumers, and that's maybe why museums are exhausting and boring. They should be a big turn on. I mean, or they should make you cry. Look at those scenes of war. Oh my gosh, they should slay you. Should be an emotional wreck when you walk through a museum. And I know this for a very much a fact. I'm sure we'll talk about it. That Bright Visor walked through a museum and was an emotional wreck in front of pieces he knew. And so that's sort of beguiling, innocent, weirdly perceptive mindset, that emotional mindset, really affected me. And I love looking at art. You know, everyone feels like, oh, I don't know what to say in front of a piece of art. I don't know what to say about this balance of, you know, color wheel stuff. That's all to be put aside. If you feel something, that's the right way to look at a piece of art.
Let's back up and talk a little bit about his early life that you write about, the experiences that really shaped him. First, I'm interested in his obsession with objects. That manifests itself really early on, it seems. He has this blue box that he keeps his treasures. What do you understand about that obsession with objects early on?
Yeah, so Bright Visor was born in 1971, so he's... I mean, everyone else listening thinks he's old. I kind of think he's young because I was born a little before him. But let's just put that aside for a moment.
He seems young to me.
Young to me, too. Yeah. Come on. Let's go. I mean, a lot of people say when I wrote about this art thief, like, you know, was this historical? So I love the fact that, no, Bright Visor is like in his 50s right now. So we're talking about greatest art thief who's ever lived, but he's alive right now.
Yeah.
Even at the youngest age, you know, kids, I have three children myself, so I know about children and obsessions. He was actually... maybe born in the wrong century, but in the right part of the world where Europe is filled with historical treasures. And even at the youngest age, he was very, very close with his maternal grandfather, and they would walk in the hills near Alsace where Julius Caesar started building, you know, forts in, you know, 0 BC. So it's like kind of hard for me to get my head around here. Like, you know, that's a very old house in Salt Lake City, 1920,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And again, you know, with his openness and his genuineness, he would search for like artifacts in the hills of Alsace and find pieces of crossbows that were literally 6, 7, 8 centuries old. And these were like, when he would touch them, it was like he gave off electrical sparks. He's like, oh my God, this has been buried in the soil maybe for 500 years and now I get to touch it.
Yeah.
And I can kind of understand that. You know, I collected baseball cards as a kid, but shoot, he collected, you know, medieval artifacts. And his grandfather, perhaps inadvisedly, said, you can take that home. Because obviously the grandfather saw the son's eyes, and he would take these little bits and pieces of tile and pieces of arrowheads and crossbows, and he put them in this blue plastic box in the house in which he lived in. And he told me that he kept it in the basement. It was sort of his secret stash. I don't think his parents would have minded, but he would go down to this box, and he said that he would just – when he was an only child and kind of a loner, kind of a difficult kid, and he would go down to this box and just hold on to these objects and feel whole, feel healthy, feel completely at peace, and not only that, probably ecstatic.
Was he a Luddite? He had a disdain for, like, kids in that era were video games, you know, and technology was kicking in for sure. It was a little bit before the internet, but he stayed away from all of that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a journalist. I make my living talking to strangers. I'm like, I'm embarrassed to admit that I'm semi-glued to my cell phone. You know, I like to be in touch with everybody everywhere, but I really like sometimes Bright Visor's perspective on things. You know, he really was a loner. He liked to be, didn't like to be disturbed. He's like, anything. He told me that growing up, anything that kids liked, video games, parties, you know, drinking beer, were things that just seemed really weird to him. And then he said, well, you know, now cell phones, email, text messages, all, why would you want to make it easier to get in touch with you? He was like, all we're doing is making it more easier to be bothered. And so he recoils from most of these things. So I like the word Luddite. You know, my definition of it is like someone who's sort of opposed to modern technology. And I don't think that's wrong.
Yeah.
You know, he said to me, that he felt like his problem was that he was born in the wrong century, and that really his attachment was to right before the age of mechanization, the industrial age sort of rose in the 1800s, and anything before that, literally every part of everything before their machines was made by hand.
Yep.
We've all benefited from modern society for sure, but
everything's original. There's no reproduction necessarily.
Yeah, some of the things he stole were weird, like medical kits, but every piece was made, like there wasn't replacing, like you broke a piece, the medical kit's done. There was no replacement, and he found beauty in that. And the way he described it affected me too. I was like, I can see that, you know, trephining thing where you put a hole in someone's brain doesn't seem like something, a piece of art, but when you sort of phrase it as like, this was constructed piece by piece, look at this burled handle on this thing that you used to punch a hole in someone's skull, but isn't it beautiful? Look at the grain of the wood and the way it's attached. I mean, so lovely. And I'm like, yeah, it actually is. And so it was fun to spend time with Bright Visor and hear a true anesthete and a criminal's take on the world of art.
But there's two things going on, aren't there? And we'll get to this when we talk a little bit more about when you're having these conversations. Well, let's talk about it now, actually. Because there's the part that you admire that is appealing to you, his world perspective about technology and art and originality. And then there's the part that you know he's an art thief and has lied. What do you make of that as a journalist, as you're, you know, as you're talking to him and trying to manage which of the things you believe? Now, clearly you'll go back and fact check some of this stuff, of course, but how do you manage that part?
I mean, I think the first thing I want to say is because I hear myself talking to you and sort of like there's a lot of like weird admiration coming out. The first thing I want to say, I think that you and I can speak for about 2 months on all the problems of modern society. But one of the things that is the most wonderful thing, one of the most wonderful things about modern society are museums. I mean, we get to go see priceless, amazing, socially important works of art for a couple of dollars or even free. We get to be as close to them. Like, museums are one of the great social goods of the world. And Breitwieser was a cancer on this. I completely disavow this. I think what he did was horrible, and I need that to be clear. However, there was an appealing element to him. Now, was he lying to me? Well, everyone talking to a journalist wants to put their best foot forward. And so, as I mentioned, spending more than a decade on this project, you know, I didn't just take Breitwieser's word on things. I interviewed the police officers that chased after him. I interviewed the lawyers. I was given boxes and boxes and boxes of documents. I got every police report on all of his crimes. I was able to confirm the general beats of it. Now, when it gets to the depth of things and the emotions, I've been a journalist for a long time. You know, I like to ask questions in six different ways. I have to go with my gut. Of course, Breitwieser was shaping things, but there was an emotional honesty that I can't deny. But I don't think in the book I tell any reader, I don't really like to tell readers what to believe. If you like to read, then there's sort of a, I'm not saying whether this book is good or not. The story is fantastic. Let me just tell you that much. Whether you like the book, that's up to you. But a good book, I believe, is a dance with a reader. And, you know, I respect people that read books. I'm not going to tell you what to think. You decide whether you like Breitwieser or not. You decide whether he's full of it or not. I tried to lay down everything and I threw myself into this wholly, but I mean, even his own psychologists who reamed him out for being, you know, a narcissist and a cancer in society said, well, it's clear that this guy's an esthete and is truly in love with beauty and art. And so I really think that that part is quite true, and there's no doubt that he stole from 201 museums.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you a little bit more about the museum part that you mentioned, because this is something you also write about in the book, that museums rely on public trust. And there's almost this social contract at play when we go into one, that people are going to, in the museum, they're offering this art, they're offering history and these ancient documents and objects. And in exchange, we want you to not steal them, keep them there and let other people enjoy them. And part of the ethic that you write about from museum is the importance of preserving that accessibility for all types of people. And that's one of the ideas, that art shouldn't just be for multimillionaires and billionaires to hang on their walls. That if you just kept art behind lock and key, as you say in the book, that would make them like a bank, not a museum.
Yeah, I mean, the mission of a museum is to put you as close as possible to a priceless work of art, of cultural history, of a sense of place. I mean, when you go into a museum anywhere in the world, and I love doing this, you know, you are literally inches away from the most magnificent and valuable objects that exist. Now, I don't think museum curators like to talk about this too much, but what's going to get you to go to a museum? Like, if there's a big announcement saying, hey, guess what? We got a great new security system, or how about we got a bunch of Van Goghs? You know, what's going to get you to go there? Of course, you want to see the art. Nobody wants to see an iron barred cage in front of their Picasso. I fear that it could be coming there. And Breitwieser exploited this social pact that you mentioned, where we as a people have decided that it's very important to see the greatest works of art as close as possible, and we're going to leave them where they are.
Yeah.
And if we really want to see it again, you know what? We'll just go back to the museum. But it's
you can't put it on your nightstand as much as you want to caress it every morning. Sorry.
C'est interdit, as they say in French. That is not allowed.
Michael Finkel, his new book is called The Art Thief, a true story of love, crime, and a dangerous obsession. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. I wanted to ask you more about this sort of psychology part, because this is another thing that you do kind of work through in the book. And to me, it was like, oh, he's a kleptomaniac. That seemed clear to me at some point, but was he? And he's also a narcissist, and that seems to be one of the diagnoses he used to get. I mean, you also write that there's this emptiness that never feels filled. So you put it in the book, that there was something else going on. So what do you understand about the psychology behind what Stefan is going through?
Right. So over the course of our relationship, Brett Wieser gained his trust enough so that he actually signed a document saying that I could look at his psychology reports.
Wow.
I know. So I was able to read 5 different psychologists' take on Brett Wieser. And, you know, I don't want to get in too much into the weeds, but you mentioned kleptomania. You know, by definition, he's 100% not a kleptomaniac, which just briefly, a kleptomaniac is someone for whom stealing is the important thing. The object means very little. And then more importantly, after the theft, a kleptomaniac feels shame and regret. Brett Wieser was exactly the opposite of that. Yeah. He chose his objects quite carefully, and afterwards, party time, celebratory excitement. Yeah. Now, no shame and regret at all. Now, you mentioned earlier that once Brett Wieser lying to me, now it just comes to me that one of the things he liked to tell me was that it wasn't the thieving that really brought him true joy, or that wasn't interesting to me, it was the object he brought home. But I'm telling a little bit of BS on that. Huh. Because one of the things he liked to do, I mentioned, was remove a frame, not cut a work out of it.
Right.
And he would leave these frames and sort of, he even said to me the phrase, frames are empty, frames are my calling card. And he would put these frames, sometimes he would just show off and open another like display case and put the frame in there just to mess with the police. Mm. The police found it, as I spoke to all the police officers that were the chief inspectors that were after him, like a provocation, a sort of a show off-y move. And so I believe, and I know his later actions prove it, that Brett Wieser did like stealing. He loved art, but there was also an element of liking it. And so I'm not going to go with the whole definition of kleptomania, but there's certainly an element that he is an incorrigible, unstoppable, and obsessed thief.
It's like he was good at it, but what was he good at? He was good at kind of fading into the background. It's hard to tell what exactly the gift is. And you say in the book that there wasn't really much of a plan, or at least there didn't seem to be, early on anyway. It was mostly, you say, improvisation, that he would follow his instincts, that he wasn't interested in the grand or the complicated, that, as you said, he would do precisely what a thief would never do. Like, that was part of it. So, but he also had silicone and, like, he did have a few techniques. So what do you make of that?
Yeah, let's talk about some of his most ingenious thefts.
Yes.
They're, like, at this they're amazingly... They're intelligent and they're spontaneous. One of my favorites is he goes to the biggest museum in Belgium, the History and Art Museum of Brussels. It's like Louvre-sized.
Yeah.
And he sees a display case filled with objects that he doesn't like, that don't give him a coup de coeur. And it looks like this display case has been stolen from already. It's got all these blank spots. And he walks up to the case, and inside the case is a folded in half index card that says in French, objects removed for study. And Brett Wieser, as quick as a flash, has an idea, and he, okay, a little aside here, he breaks into this case. How do you break into a display case? You know, they have pretty good locks, and locks are hard to pick. I'm just going to tell you, Brett Wieser walked into a museum with just nothing but a Swiss Army knife, and the seams of a display case are connected with silicone glue. If you pull out the sharpest blade of your Swiss Army knife and you do these like surgical incisions up and down, left and right, you can open up the panels of a display case just enough to wriggle your hand through and grab something like a beautiful work of ivory. And then you push the panels back together and it looks, they snap back into place and it looks like the case has been untouched. The lock has never been moved. Anyway, Brett Wieser sees this sign, objects removed for study. He opens up the case. He steals the index card. He moves to another room in which he finds this Renaissance silver that he adores. We won't get into the weeds on it, but amazing chalices and mugs and this silver warship that was built for the center of a banquet table with amazingly detailed, like, silver soldiers and silver cannons and silver sails. I really want one myself. I mean, come on. This ship is
amazing. I've seen the photos, by the way, of these.
Amazing.
And we should also say he almost steals them all eventually. It just goes back and back and back.
Right, but, right. Yes. He takes a few things, and rather than rearranging things, which he used to do to make a case seem untouched, all he does is put this objects removed for study card in the middle of the case. He goes back. He goes home with his objects. He thinks, wow, I wonder if I should go back. Goes back. Nobody has reported anything stolen. Steals again and again. Steals 11 priceless silver objects out of one case, and he tells me Brad Fieser tells me the greatest art-stealing tool of all time is a bent index card. Simplicity at its finest steals millions of dollars worth of art with a bent index card.
Well, you're right that no one gets away with bold crimes for long. Luck always runs out. And of course it does for Brad Fieser. He gets to this point where he's stealing all kinds of things from all kinds of places. And it's interesting to see what happens because it begins with a kind of aesthetic ideal. But that seems to, in some way, kind of start to break down. You write that his stealing becomes dirty and maniacal. I think this is on a Katrine's kind of point of view, that he's abandoned his aesthetic ideals. What's happening to him?
I mean, we don't really need to make a comparison, but he's sometimes like an older athlete that just wants to be good. It's clear to everyone that they're failing. So Brad Fieser took everything in his entire life too far. He was an obsessive thief. He was an obsessive aesthete. There was no such thing as, oh, I have enough. My collection's complete. The spiral got deeper and deeper. And as when you're doing risky crimes like this, how long can you get away with it? I mean, 201 thefts is pretty amazing. That's about 201 more than I would get away with. But he didn't know when to stop. And like every Icarus story, there's going to be a crash. And I don't think anyone flew higher and took more risks in the whole history of art crime than Brad Fieser, which only means that his crash is going to be that much more extraordinary and devastating. And it is.
The question that you also work through in the book, I wanted to ask you about, what is it that Stefan wants out of all of this? Well, he wants beauty, I think. There's no doubt about that. He wants the thing. He wants the object. But you also write that what he really wants is to be written into the story of art.
What did Brad Fieser want? He kind of avoided fame. Does he have a big ego? Yeah, he has a big ego. Sat down and talked with a journalist ad nauseum. He fancied himself incorrectly as sort of this sensitive, great aesthete to whom the rules of society did not apply. He thought that, in his twisted logic, that museums were prisons for art. And we talked about that, you know, seeing the Mona Lisa with 400,000 of my best friends is not ideal. Yeah. And, you know, he is an egotist. He's a narcissist. All of his psychologists, even the ones that were charmed by him, agreed that he was, you know, immature, you know, self-centered, all these things. So he fancied himself like a sort of hero in the art world, not one of these billionaires that just didn't even understand art. And this is obviously flawed logic and also contributed to his mania and made the crash that we were talking about even more severe and more heartrending.
So there's this – we won't give everything away. And I have to say it's important to understand that this book works through not only the intricacies of these moments but also the detective work, the fact that he gets – ultimately, of course, caught. We do know that now. That's how we know about the story. I did want to ask, the moment when a hand is first placed on his shoulder as he's walking away with such confidence, what does that do to him? The moment that – because this has never happened to him.
Brad Fieser steals from 201 museums, but he does get caught and everything in his life falls apart. I think that just thinking about this right now, that he was so – entwined with his art that when he's – what's the opposite of entwined? Untwined. It's catastrophic. Mm. And, you know, it's a story about love, love of art, love of Anne Catherine. His mother plays a part and everything is destroyed. And he's broken by this. And, you know, the ending is sort of heartbreaking. And I do feel terrible for Brad Fieser. You mentioned earlier – probably didn't address it because I'm scatterbrained sometimes, that there's a hole inside him that can't be filled. And I did, you know, Brad Fieser sat in the passenger seat of my rental car for hours as we were driving from museums. And every time we passed a museum, I could see him perk up and then he would sort of settle down. And there was this sense of little bit of sadness, and that, you know, I talked to him about his collection at its height, and he never gave me the sense that it was enough and it was filled, and there's like this sort of trying to fill a bucket with a big hole in the bottom. And, you know, I'm not jealous of Stefan Breitwieser, and neither should you be, but it's, his actions are fascinating, but he does have something. Of course, he's wired, unfortunately, and I'm glad that he didn't hurt anybody, which sort of allowed me to make him, I don't know if anti-hero is the right word, but, you know, I think that his crimes are digestible without being too, without being too disgusted, but I think disgust is a fair reaction anyway. But there is a humanity to him, and sort of this vein of sadness that was undeniable. And I did feel that, you know, he was chasing after something that he could never quite catch.
Let's end with another story, because there's this question I wanted to ask. What is it like to visit a museum with the world's greatest art thief? Because you visited the Rubens house that we were mentioning in Belgium with him. This is kind of not where it all begins, but it's certainly one of the beginnings of this spree of theft. And you described that going with him is kind of this performance art almost. But you also talk about this incredibly intense encounter that you saw with him. Take us through that, if you would.
Yeah, we talked about Breitwieser's love of ivory and his theft of the Adam and Eve ivory sculpture 21 years after he stole this work, and it was on his bedside table for years that he could reach out and touch. I went back to the Rubens house to see this work of art that had, after a crazy journey, been returned to the museum. And I mean, sometimes being a journalist just like blows your own head. I'm like, I'm about to enter a museum with the world's greatest art thief, who, by the way, is kind of banned from museums. We put on a light disguise, and I'm like,
I was gonna say,
I'm like, the moral complications that are going through my head as we're walking from the parking lot into the building. I'm like, what do I do if he steals something? What do I, you know? And by the way, let me just admit to your listeners, I'm hoping the statute of limitations on this. Like, he was so intent. Like, he took my hand at one time and rubbed it lightly across a Peter Paul Rubens painting, and I felt the ridges of the paint. I felt, you know, paintings are three-dimensional, not two-dimensional, and I got like an electric connection, and I sort of understood it. I am not recommending that anyone touch anything in a museum, but boy, it was sort of fascinating. Mm-hmm. A piece of performance art. We go to see the Adam and Eve, and I had all these questions, and he puts his nose like right against the, by the way, highly reinforced new plexiglass box with more than two screws.
Yeah.
And I watched this change come over him, and I realized that this is not the time to ask any questions, but I wondered how long he was going to stare there. Was he going to spend a week? Was he going to spend all day? He doesn't spend very much time at all. In fact, he runs off after a couple of minutes and into this courtyard in the middle of the Rubens house, and I follow him into there, and there are tears sliding down his cheeks, and he says to me, it's like I've seen a ghost, like someone that I thought was dead come back to life. You know, he's at this point been arrested and been jailed. He's got creases at his eyes. He's got his hairline is retreating like mine. And he says to me, I think that the day I stole this Adam and Eve ivory was the highlight of my life. It was the moment that I was at my greatest, you know, skill. And he said that he regrets the time that he's wasted. And what he meant by that was the time after stealing. He really loved stealing, and I could see it. And he loved that work, which he considered his. He used that term. That was mine. That was mine. And that was basically one of the last moments I spent with him, standing there in the courtyard of the Rubens House Museum with tears sliding down his cheek, where he wished he had this Adam and Eve ivory. And of course, it belongs to all of us. It belongs to the museum, but it was a fraught, interesting, fascinating, indelible moment.
Michael Finkel, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Michael Finkel, his new book is The Art Thief, a true story of love, crime, and a dangerous obsession. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.